Burrow's furniture is built for the way you live. From ensuring easy assembly and disassembly to honoring highly requested new colors for their award-winning seating, they always have their customers in mind. Their modular seating is made out of durable materials to last and grow with you. And with Burrow, you always get fast, free shipping. Get up to 60% off during Burrow's Memorial Day sale at burrow.com/ACAST. That's burrow.com/ACAST. burrow.com/ACAST.
And then at the end of the day, I mean, it doesn't depend on how many problems you've got, it depends on how long you hold on to it.
This is Property Investory, where we talk to successful property investors to find out more about their stories, mindset, and strategies. I'm Tarun Shum, and in this episode, we're speaking with successful property investor and accountant, David Wu. Join us as we delve into the many properties he's invested into, the power of investing in property, the importance of holding long term, and much, much more. First off, Wu tells us a little bit about what he does.
I'm a chartered accountant in private practice. Basically, I have a practice in the Sydney CBD, accounting and tax. I've got two business partners. Been in practice since 1997, so 20-odd years. Well, we do a lot of tax return work, but my expertise and favorite is in tax planning, tax advisory, especially in the property-related matters relation to tax.
And he shares what a typical day looks like for him.
A typical day starts with, obviously, coming back to the office, I read a financial review. That's very important because I need to apprise of what's happening in the financial world. And even though I'm an accountant, I need to broaden my knowledge and view on all aspects on financial matters. And then I obviously hit the email and then see whether there's an email that I need to attend to urgently. And then I follow my plan. I've got a day list. So what you need to do, etc. The night before, I list down what is need to be done. And then I go to look at the job list, review some of the jobs. As I told you before, I'm looking at the tax return, so I'm getting out of the way. And then I spend the other good part of the day looking at how to make sure that clients are being serviced. I have this, not sure if you heard about that, the red activity, blue activity, and black activities. So red activities are those that's basically not really productive, like looking at administration. The blue are the one that is actual charging the client by reviewing the files, etc. And then the black activities are the one that's basically marketing to train staff and then to make sure that we have a plan in place to bring in new client and then to generate fees. So I spend a lot of time in doing that sort of black activities.
In regards to this color system Wu uses for dividing up his tasks, he tells us where he learned it from and a little more about it.
I learned from someone else. Yeah, I actually, it's not original from me. I have to pay credit to those. I don't know who invented it. But then look at it. I mean, a lot of us just, these are the main three main activity. The one that is generating your income instantly, which is the blue. The one that is not generating income as such, that's overhead, that you're chit-chatting, the admin. The one that is potentially generating income in the future, the black activity. So depending on how you focus on those, a lot of people just focus on the blue one, which is good, generating income instantly, but then you have to look at longer-term plan where you can get some income in the future.
Wu goes on to tell us about his upbringing, what he did after high school, and when he immigrated to Australia.
I was born in Hong Kong and then raised up there. And then typical middle-class family, my parents, they are businessmen doing some export trade. So in a way, we have a family of six. I'm the eldest one. I've got two brothers and one younger sister. So we are quite lucky because we are from our start, we are being looking up, being looked after by the parents, we are being have good education. I mean, and then we have a lot of good clothing, and then live in good environment. We can't say that we're very rich, but we're middle class, typical Hong Kong people. So yeah, and then I study science in my high school, and then wanted to go into the medicine to study doctor, but I failed my university entrance exam, so I couldn't get into medicine, get into science. And then after graduate in 83, I studied a master's degree and doing some research work in Hong Kong. And at that time, and then the family, my father planned to migrate over here because of, at that time, they have the problem with the 1997 China taking over Hong Kong. So my parents were also afraid of that political situation. So we, so he applied for migration, and we got the visa, the burn visa, and then we migrated here in 1986. And then once I'm in Australia, I wanted to continue my science work, but then not much opportunity there, so I switched into accounting. So a bit of a big change.
Although most of Wu's family decided to stay in Australia, not all of them did.
Well, my parents stay, obviously because of the business connection. It's just that for us, we have to come over here to study. And then now all brothers and sisters, they are here, but my parents are still in Hong Kong. Obviously, they prefer the way of life over there. So all of me and my brothers and sisters, they're all citizens, but my parents, they're still holding a permanent resident visa only because they didn't spend enough time here to get a citizenship.
With the current situation in Hong Kong with the Chinese government, Wu tells us as to whether his parents are considering moving elsewhere.
It's a mixed feeling. So obviously they wanted to stay there because of the connections and of the relatives there, and then the language, and then the environment. On the other hand, there come a point where the protests in Hong Kong getting more severe, and then affecting not only the, you know, the day-to-day, affecting the day-to-day life of every people, ordinary people. So they are seriously thinking of coming over here to stay for good.
Schooling in Hong Kong for Wu was a little different from how schools operate in Australia.
At that time, back in my days, they have actually 13 years. So 6 years is primary school. And in high school, we call Form 1 to Form 7. So that means 7 plus 6 is 13. So Form 1 and to Form 6 is equivalent to the Year 7 to Year 12 here. And then the Form 7, which is, they call it a pre-matriculation school year, that's preparing you for the university. So that means that we have 7 years of high school. So the system in Hong Kong is very much very called spoon-feeding. So it's just, you know, a lot of focus on academic, not much as a diverse, broad-based teaching as in Australia. And then every people just doing a lot of study work, tuition, and just want to get into the elite University of Hong Kong, and in Chinese University of Hong Kong. And at that time, the only two universities, which is, you know, famous, which is Chinese University and Hong Kong University. So a lot of people spend a lot of time, money, effort in trying to get into those prestigious university.
When he was in Hong Kong, Wu did work a little before he came to Australia and decided to pursue further studies.
Yeah, I worked a little bit in my father's company to help him out in the import-export trading. When I was young, I had always had the intention to succeed my family's to help him out. But then I find it to be quite difficult because my interest is not in that area. So I, after studying my master in Hong Kong, which is also science, I just have the opportunity to come over here to explore, to see what opportunities open to me. And then I find it, okay, the science, and then you can either do further research or you go to do teaching work. And at the time, not that many opportunities. So I look at around, and okay, may as well do a master's degree in commerce, which is a degree that did not require any commerce first degree. So if you have a science background, you can still do a master in commerce. So to give me some knowledge into the accounting and business world. So I then did this. It's only a 2-year course. It's UNSW Master of Commerce. So I did that one in 87, 88. So then I find it to be quite interesting in the areas where I choose accounting, because obviously accounting is the basic of everything. So once you know accounting, then you can branch into a lot of areas, know the numbers and finance and what have you.
Whilst he was studying, Wu decided not to obtain a part-time job because of the mindset he grew up with.
At the time, I was full-time study, and then with hindsight, I would have been better if I get some job opportunity. But then, being from Hong Kong, the mindset is okay, study, and then you can find a job. So we don't have the mentality of doing part-time job and doing part-time study. So, and also as I said, my background is relatively comfortable, and then we don't need to work in order to get a living. So, but that's good and bad, because obviously that means I don't have the exposure of getting some real life experience in work, which is totally different from what you learn at school and uni.
He tells us a bit about where he lived with his siblings when he first moved to Australia.
We're living one house together, and then when we migrated here, we don't know everybody. So my father bought a house near my uncle in the southern area, in Blackhurst, near Hurstville. So we all lived together in one house, and then it was a very big house, so a lot of things to look after, to clean, to do a lot of stuff. And then obviously in Hong Kong, we have some people to help. Like in Hong Kong, we have got the Philippine domestic helper. In Australia, obviously, everything has to be done by ourselves. So that's another reason why my parents didn't want to come over here in the first place.
Wu walks us through the process by which he arrived at his current place of employment.
After my study, actually, I went back to Hong Kong to work for 6 months to join a big accounting firm called Pricewaterhouse. And then after 6 months, I think I can't stand the work pressure in Hong Kong, and I actually wanted to come back to Australia for good. So I just came back in. Luckily, at that time, I got a job in a small accountancy firm in Crow's Nest. So I joined them, and for the bit of, I think, one a bit year. And then, unfortunately, at the time, we experienced the recession we had to have in 1991. So at the time, my firm said, look, they can't retain me, because obviously they've got to downsize, and because of the recession, not much work. So I was asked to leave, and then I spent about a few months without work. And then after that, I have been able to apply for a job in my current firm, which is Richard A. Bob. I think that was in August 1991. And at the time, obviously, it was quite difficult to find jobs. So I said, okay, if there's opportunity, I might as well grab it. And since August 1991 until now, I'm staying with this firm, Richard A. Bob. I became the partner in 1997.
When the firm first started, it was about 3 partners and 12 staff, and not much, as Wu tells us, has changed since then.
Actually, the firm was started by the founding partner who found the firm in 1982. So when I joined in 1991, they already quite decent size. And after I joined the firm in 1991, I worked 6 years, and then until 1997, I became admitted as a partner. We still have 3 partners now, and then the firm is probably around the same size, about 10 staff. So we have been moving a few times. When we first joined the firm, we were in Castlereagh Street. And then we moved to O'Connell Street, a bigger firm, a bigger size office in 2003. And then in 2008, when the GFC hit, we have to downsize and move over here to the current location in Hunter Street. We are here since 2008, so for the very good part of 11 years.
Wu explains why downsizing for businesses occurred due to events like the recession and GFC.
At the time, when 1991, the famous Paul Keating basically said, okay, we have to have the recession. So at that time, it was a lot of business activity. They shrink because obviously our business rely on the client's activity. So the client business activity, the more they have, the more we'll be able to handle the tax return accounting work. So a lot of them, they just either retrench and then some of them they close down. So that's why they don't need the accountant, and then they don't need a lot of other tax work. So that's why we have to have this. If we don't have that work, we need to sort of reduce our staff level as well. So yeah, in overhead as well. So we have to reduce the size of the office and what have you. Same in the GFC, it's very much the same. A lot of business, they actually GFC was worse than the recession in 1991 because a lot of business actually, we witness a lot of the business, they really have to retrench a lot of staff, especially in our firm. A lot of us, our clients are property based, so developers and investors. So if the property affected, like a lot of the people, they cannot build and sell their property, so they'll affect a lot of their business.
He tells us about the cycles a firm like theirs goes through over time when it comes to the number of clients they have.
The clients basically disappear, and then either they reduce in the volume, and then we at the time when we moved to O'Connell Street, it was quite good because that's the reason why we moved from Castle Ray to O'Connell. That's between 2003, and that is a booming period. Obviously, as you know, at the time, it was going up. And then a lot of people buy off plan, and then et cetera. I may have to share another story later on in the podcast about that point as well. And then since 2003, 4, and 5, and then building up all the way until 2007 and 8, then we hit the GFC. So it's in a cycle.
There is a reason why the accounting firm focuses on property, which Wu tells us.
The history of the firm is like the founding partner, Richard Bob. He's Lebanese, so he's got a lot of Lebanese clients to start with, and he founded the firm. So a lot of Lebanese, as you know, they are into the building game. So we still have a lot of clients. My current client, they are also Lebanese. And then we still have other clients as well, which is in the building game. Like we have Greek client, we have Italian client. But the main source of clients to start with are the Lebanese clients. And then there are a lot of building constructions and then property investment. And hence our firm, most of the clientele, they are property focused.
For Wu, his parents had an impact on him getting into property. And he also tells us a bit about why he thinks property is so powerful.
It's property has been the main game in Hong Kong because of the Hong Kong background. Hong Kong is a very tiny place, and then a lot of people. So property become very scarce commodity. So a lot because of our family history. I mean, obviously business is one thing. My father, my mother worked very, very hard when they are young, and then based on this manufacturing and then import-export business. But once they've got generate a little bit more income, then they put money in the property. And you see wealth grow substantially when you have the good property portfolio. It grows so rapid and so fast that you can't even earn that sort of money in your lifetime. It's chalk and cheese. So that's started my interest in property, because obviously how much time you got maximum, you got 24 hours a day. Even if you work 24 hours a day to earn your income, it cannot compare with the scale that the property can afford you. You can have one property, two property, and let it grow and let the income compound. And that's why the property investment is so powerful.
Yeah, I totally agree. And especially in Hong Kong, the price of property over there, it's just for a unit, it's just so high.
Hong Kong is a little bit unrealistic.
So that's very true. To give listeners maybe a perspective, how much would you say on average just a two-bedroom unit is worth now in Hong Kong, say in comparison?
Depends on the location, I suppose. If you're in a good location, a two-bedroom unit, in Australian dollar term, you're looking at $1.5, $2 million.
Yeah, that's what I heard as well. And it's fascinating because like...
And the size is small, I tell you. And the size, don't think about the size in two-bedroom. It's about, you know, here, maybe about 80, 90 square meters. No, but in Hong Kong, two-bedroom unit, we're looking at about 50, 60 square meter max.
That's what I hear as well. So it's like, wow, you don't get very much there. And that's probably why I think a lot of people, especially from Hong Kong and China, prefer sort of to purchase property in Australia because you get land. You know, for that kind of money, if you sold up your units, however many you have, you could easily buy yourself, you know, many, many houses here.
Absolutely right.
That's fascinating.
Yeah. So after the Hong Kong experience, obviously, when I come over here, it's looking at the property here as well. So I and then exposed to people's investment, and then I find, okay, cool. I mean, property investment is not bad. So actually my parents start investing in property, and then I also personally start looking at investing in property.
Wu's first property was quite a surprising one and gave him great experience when it came to property investing.
First of all, it's my home here in Australia. Obviously, it was near my father's place. So we actually bought a rundown property and we actually built our home back in 1992. It was quite a daunting experience because we have to, because we have no experience, we have to rely on the builder that's referred to us. Actually, the builder is also the builder who sold the property to my parents. So, okay, we bought a property run down, and then we have to demolish it. And at the time, we didn't demolish it. There's a situation where people want to buy a property. It was a Jeep property, which is a weather board roof and what have you. I don't know that term, but then they actually literally come to move the whole property on a big truck and moved it away.
I didn't realize it was still possible in Sydney. I know they do in Queensland a lot, but not in Sydney.
Because some people buy it, and then it was, I still remember it was it was early morning because they had to do it when the road is clear, no traffic, it was done. And then the whole thing, they move it on a very big truck and move it away. So instead of demolishing it, the whole house moved away. Then we start a plan, then build, and what have you. So that's why I've got the experience. I think to buy land and build, you have the instant equity because obviously we look around to look at buying houses, but then the prices, it's much more expensive than the one that we spend. Obviously, it depends on how much money you prepare to spend, how good are your finishes. But then I still believe this first property experience gave me some good insight into, you know, to buy and build compared to just the buy of finished products. And that's my first property exposure. It's in Blakehurst.
So that's a really, really good area down there.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, near my father's place. And then obviously, because that's my first home, so we spent all the time. But then it's not easy job because at that time we called the owner builder, so we have to do a lot of stuff, and then we have to keep the builders doing the job. We have to keep on chasing them up, and then do a lot of running around, choosing the material, and it's a lot of hard work to be owner builder. Yeah.
So, how long did that process take from start to finish, if you remember?
About 12 months.
That's a reasonable amount of time.
Reasonable amount of time. Yeah, yeah. The delay is basically from the neighbor. Because the plan is to go to council, and then they don't like this, they don't like that. And then also afterward, we need to build a fence in the front and then also get some objection from the neighbor. So, I mean, that's the only delay. Otherwise, the process is quite smooth. And the builder is good. I mean, he worked hard for us and then etc. So, I mean, 12 months is not too bad in the scheme of things, yes.
Is that still your current home or have you?
Yes, it is. It is.
Wu goes on to tell us whether he has been holding on to his properties as he did with his first one or buying and selling.
Bit of both. That's the actually my father, when after he migrated here, he purchased some units in Hurstville. And at the time, it was quite good. We had the intention of holding it for long term. Then my father is that type of person who, when he sees profit, he wants to realize it. So, and then unfortunately, at that time, we sold all the property. I think I remember at that time when we bought in 1992, and when we sold in 1997. So at a decent profit, but then obviously with hindsight, if you could have kept it until today, it would be much different. It would just this different ballgame.
He takes us through a journey of other property investments that he's done, from one in Queensland to another one in New South Wales.
After my home, obviously, and then I am looking at buying property. We bought property in Queensland. At the time, you know, I don't know whether you remember, probably you're too young, there's a company called Young & Co. They promise to fly you up there, inspect the property, and then if you're not good, then they sign a contract. And then, if I remember still, it was a townhouse in Runaway Bay in the Gold Coast. So me and my wife grew up there, and then sounds good. And then we bought it. And with bank loan, and then we held it for I think 4 or 5 years at the time, and then because of the distance, we couldn't look after it because obviously it's in the state, so we have sold it, and that's my second venture in the property, and then we also purchased one property in Bankstown. Also, around that time, and then also we held it for 4 or 5 years, and then we sold it. I think it's mainly because at the time the return is not that good, and then we want to use the money for other purposes. And then my third attempt is in Rockdale. At the time, it was actually market was on the move up. There was 2002, and my real estate agent friend bought one there of the plan, and I said, well, if he buy one there, it can't be wrong. So I just borrowed him and bought one there. And that was it was in Rockdale Princess Highway. It was quite good. And then I held it for I think around 8 years. It was 2002, and then we go through, and then we went through the GFC, and then 2008, and then I have to sell in 2000, and I think we sold in 2010 because obviously because of financial situation, so I've got to realize it, and I've got to move on. So, but again, with hindsight, I were able to hold on to that. So now, it was a one-bedroom, one-study unit. I bought it for $350 off the plan and sold it for $360. It's a pretty even. But now, how can you buy a one-bedroom unit in Rockdale at that price?
Wu tells us more about his worst investing moment, which was the Rockdale property, and elaborates on why he purchased and sold it.
That is absolutely the worst one. It is actually, I think the lesson to learn is basically, you buy over the plan, it's okay, and you buy on a rising market, it's okay. But then I suppose, let's learn it, when bad times come, when bad times hit, I think you have to have the holding power, you have to have the determination and mindset to say, look, this is your original purchase, what is it, what's the purpose for it, if it's a long-term investment or just buy and flick. And I suppose depends on whether you really have to sell. And with hindsight, I don't have to sell. But at the time, all factors point that you better sell and then move on. So I were able, actually, if at that time I can refinance, and then it would have been better off by not selling. The reason why I purchased is because I still think it is property for the long term is a good investment. So plus the agent at the time, he said it is a good purchase, and obviously I basically because he's got experience in the area, and then I think this shouldn't be too bad, and really for long term. And then actually it was a good unit. I got good rent, and then it was the architecture, and then the finish was good, and then the one bedroom size is good with a good balcony overlooking the Rockdale Plaza, and then you can see the airplane coming up and down in the sky. So I think it's good buy. But as to why I need to sell, I think at the time I look at, because it was negative year, and then also the cash flow probably may be a little bit challenging, and also at the time everything's going down, and then you know, back in the GFC, the property got hit big time, and I've been through that. A lot of property have been dropping, so the fear is it will drop further. So that is the reason why I sell. Obviously, two things: cash flow and the fear that it's going to drop further. But that's actually I suppose not enough information at the time for me to make good decision. I could have done a bit more better research, and then instead of just following everybody people's on the sale, not only me and even my parents, they also sell their home in 2009 at the time. Obviously at then it was a good price, but with hindsight could have held on to it.
I think that's all about hindsight, and I guess we all learn from those lessons, because now that we look back and go, oh wow, you know, as you said, property is long term and it's a long term investment, but at sometimes circumstances, as you said, cash flow wasn't easy to maintain, then you have to make that decision. And I can relate to that, because my parents had properties in Birkenhead Point and also in the Sydney CBD as well, and timing wise they sold it at the wrong times, because yeah, one was at a loss and one was at a profit. So it ended up balancing. But imagine, I'm thinking, if they held on to both of them, gosh, the the properties that they're now worth twice as much as what they bought. I think they bought it for about 300,000 back then, and now it's worth over a mil. it's painful, because I would have said to them, give it to me instead.
So I always told my dad, I mean, okay, some people sell because they want to realize profit. But then once you realize profit, what do you want to do with the money? Unless you put that into the property. But if that's the case, why sell? Because you incur transaction costs and stamp duty and whatever. So unless it is a switching of portfolio, like you switch from one area to another area, or you're recycling, or you're just selling the old one and buy a new one, or you switch from residential to commercial. I mean, property is a long-term gain. And then at the end of the day, I mean, it depends on, how not many, depends on not, it doesn't depend on how many property you've got, it depends on how long you hold on to it.
Having previously told us about his worst investing moment, Wu now tells us about one of his best investing moments, where various components necessary for investing seem to align.
It has to be a reason purchase. Obviously, I've got shared with you before, I recently purchased some land in Thornton, the Hunter Valley area. So that's with the intention to build a duplex and to sell. So that has taken some research work, and then obviously research is very important. You have to do a lot of homework, and with the help of professionals like teamwork, like experts, and also with the guts to able to make the decision and to take calculated risk. So all this happened because obviously it started in July when I start to look at refinancing my home loan, and then I basically have the opportunity to get help from the finance expert and get some cash out from the refinance, and then obviously have the ability to look around opportunity. And then at the time Daniel come along, and then we have always been talking about this for a long time, and he have given me this opportunity, and then we went up to Hunter a few times, and then actually this block of land is not the one that we had planned to look at. But suddenly at the time, the agent said, okay, this is proper land, it's available, it just come out. And I look at it, and just fell in love with it straight away because it's a corner block. It's good for a duplex. And then I just make the decision to acquire it. So I think, I guess the lesson to learn is you have got to have a lot of things aligned, like your research, your the help with the team, like professional who are expert in what they do, and then the timing, the finance, and the ability to make the decision at the same time. And now the land has been acquired, settled, and now is in the process of submitting plan to council for the duplex to be built. So I'm quite happy with this one.
He goes on to explain a little more about the piece of land he bought on which he is planning to build a duplex and why it was such a good choice and investment.
The land I purchased is quite good. It's in terms of pricing, it's about 241 for a block of 600 square meter. And the good thing about it is the corner block, so we can build two duplex. And then it's a fixed price contract, no variation with the builder. And the build is around the 580 mark. I think all up, including cost and whatever you is looking at around the 800 mark. Yeah. So I'm planning to look at the duplex. So do some research. You're looking at selling one duplex at around the 460 to 480 mark. So roughly in gross term, you're looking at about 120, 150 uplift in the sale. So I believe the duplex is good because obviously it's in terms of affordability. If it's house and land, you're looking at more towards the about the 500,000 mark. So for entry, the person buyer, the 460 to 480 mark will be more affordable. So that's why I pitch at that level.
When asked about whether he wants to hold on to one or two titles after the completion of the duplex, Wu informs us it will depend on the situation.
It will on two titles because duplex is already on two titles. So I can either hold on to one and sell one. It depends on circumstances, depends on whether I want to hold, I can hold on to that and for long-term investment because if you look at the rent, I was told that you're looking at around the 5% yield. So it's not too bad if I want to hold on. And then it depends on circumstances because if I use this as a security to do the next, if the bank allow, I may as well hold on to that and then keep on doing building a portfolio. And so depends on the situation. Yeah.
Wu tells us about what he plans on doing in regards to building his portfolio, of which there are two parts.
Property supposed to be purchased for long-term hold. And all things being equal, unless there are some disaster that's different. So that's first point. And second point is I try to diversify into an area where you want to create equity instead of waiting for equity to come. So that's why I venture into this buy land and build project. So basically I can create equity upfront. And also I may look into the third part is I may look into diversify into non-residential, like commercial or industrial area, where obviously diversification is a key in investments, whether it's in property or in other asset classes. So you need to diversify. So I'm looking into in that as well. Actually, incidentally, my father's family company has got one property, which is non-residential, so it's commercial property. So getting good yield. So you're looking at least 7% yield. Obviously, the capital growth may not be as fantastic as residential, but you just have to balance your purpose and your aim, whether you want to go for yield or go for growth, and you have to have a balanced portfolio. So in the next few years, my aim is to look at the about field. Like, if there's good opportunity for buy and hold property, I will look at that, and also buy and build equity, and also into non-residential property.
Wu lets us know what separates successful property developers from those who are less successful, informing us some of the most common strategies developers and investors use to create wealth.
Most important is obviously the developer. They have a very, first of all, is important is the profit you make is when you buy, not when you sell. So the site selection is of paramount importance. Because a lot of people, they just look at, okay, buying the site doesn't really consider whether any value can be added to it. So most of my property, successful property clients, developer clients, they have to look at, they're very picky on the site. They don't overpay, and then they value, if there's a good site, they will put good money on it. And then they know how to add value to that site for development purposes. And that need knowledge, and that need experience, and that need teamwork, advice. Because that is, it's just the same piece of land. You may see it differently from the other, but the one who is successful, who look at it, see, they are very creative. They can see, okay, how can you add value to this land, make the GR, the gross realization, to be, 5 million instead of 3 million, so to speak. So that's important. And many of them, they have also have to have the ability to take risk. And I mean, development is not a normal game for them. That they have to take risk, but they have to take calculated risk, and they have the experience, obviously, learn from their previous project, and they will take calculated risk to go into project. I mean, typical clients, the return on property development is 30% plus. Many of our clients, obviously, there will be a situation where you have a lower return, but then in the main, they're looking at least that one before they make it worthwhile.
Wow, that's great. That is a very, very good return, especially if you know that, out of, say, $1 million, let's just take, for example, there's going to be $300,000 worth of profit. That's more than a year's salary on most people's.
And many of our clients, they actually do the apartment building. So they are bigger scale instead of just land and home and land package. And then they just build apartment, not even townhouse apartment, like in the, 100 and 150 apartments. So that's the scale that they're doing. But obviously, there are a lot of skills, a lot of hard work, a lot of headaches involved during the process.
The importance of a good structure when it comes to investing is what Wu emphasizes next, as well as the various aspects of property needed to be examined before one can even think about buying anything, from tax to risk.
One point I forgot to mention is they also need a good structure to start with. Obviously, not only good land, they need a good structure, because obviously once you got into a wrong structure, then it will be very costly to unravel it, and then it will be reducing your profits. So a lot of them, they have to plan ahead. So many of our clients, the experience before is that they purchase the property in certain such structure and then come to seek our advice. And I told them that's too late because you already, purchased it, set. So what I suggest them is, before you even contemplate buying anything, come to have a chat with us, and then we can just look at all the issues, the tax, the risk, and also how to distribute the profits in a tax-effective way, and how to manage whether you're going to hold or you're going to sell, or how to perpetuate your property to the next generation. Because obviously, property gain, or assets, you want to create it, okay, you want to preserve it, okay, and then you want to perpetuate it. Because obviously, you are here for only a certain limited period of time in this world. You are you can't bring your property portfolio with you when you come to the end of your journey. So you have to pass on to the next generation. So that's very important. We always, the first question to ask the client before they even start the project is, what is your exit strategy? What is your exit strategy? What do you want to do? Because if they have different exit strategy, it will affect different structure, different way of how to approach the project. So that's very important. So we are taking a holistic approach, and then obviously not only looking at just profits, we're looking at how to distribute that profit. And mind you, tax is one thing, but you only pay tax when you have profits. So my suggestion to the client is, okay, you pay the right amount of tax, okay, but don't obviously legally we try to make sure that it's the minimum. But then paying some tax is good, okay, obviously good for the society, good for the government, but we will try our very best to make sure that it is the minimum tax that you legally are allowed to pay.
Wu gives us an example of what a good structure can do in terms of profit from investment, as well as what kind of structure is good for passing investments to the next generation.
A typical example is the client bought investment property in the name of a company. And then obviously they want to buy a whole and for long term, etc. And then the question is, obviously you buy in a company, the disadvantage is when you sell, okay, the company need to pay tax on the profit at the flat rate, at the moment 30%. Not only that, and when you sell, when you hold property for more than 12 months, the government have got a concession, capital gain tax concession, you can discount your capital gain by 50%. When you hold it in structures like individual, trust, super fund, but not in company. So if you purchase in company, you make a profit, say you make $100,000 in capital gain, you need to pay $30,000 in tax. Whereas if you buy in the name of a trust or individual, when you make $100,000 in capital gain, the taxable portion is only $50,000, because there's a discount.
That's only after a year though.
After a year, of course, have you? Yeah, I'm looking at holding for long term investment, not for development. Okay, yeah. So, and then if you hold it in a property, hold it in a company rather than hold it in a trust, you probably cannot pass the company to the next generation without changing the shares in the company, or you have to sell the property in the company to somebody else. Whereas if you buy in the name of a trust, you can pass to the next generation by changing the control of the trust, but not the ownership. So the property is still under the name of the trust, still owned by the trust, but when you want to pass to the next generation, it's easy, just change control. There's no change of ownership. Yeah, so that way the trust structure is better than the company structure in this example.
Wu lets us know if there's a minimum amount of properties developers or investors need before they start thinking about needing different structures, or if it's just based on the risk that is involved.
It usually depends on the risk involved, and there's no minimum amount. Obviously, you have to have, to make it worthwhile to have two structures, you have the cost consideration, you have to have certain, maybe as a rule of thumb, if you have more than three or four property, then you can consider moving into different structures, especially if you have different class, like one residential and non-residential property.
In terms of mentors, Wu tells us about certain people he has sought advice from over the course of his property journey, as well as other sources he seeks advice from.
I had a mentor before, but not in the property journey. It's in general for personal development. We used to have a group meeting every month to just for all the business people to come together to brainstorm, to do mastermind session. But then the mentor has since moved on to overseas, so we don't have that anymore. But in terms of property, I don't have a mentor as such, but I have people who I seek advice from, like the team player, the experts like the finance guy, the property guy, and we usually bounce ideas from each other, so as to, because obviously you only have one mind, so if you have two minds, three minds, it's always better than one mind. So that's I get my actually mindset from a lot of reading. I read a lot of books for personal development and also for wealth creation, etc. So I think it's important to feed your mind with positive idea and with feed your mind with lessons and journey of other successful people.
For Wu, books have played an important part in his property journey, and it tells us about some of his favorites.
I've got a lot of books that I read, but then a few I want to share or recommend is, the first of all is called The Richest Man in Babylon. That's by George Clason. And that will give a lot of people some basic idea of what's wealth creation is like. Then wealth is actually not difficult to create if you know the way to create it. That's that lesson from that book. The second book I would refer or recommend is called Think and Grow Rich by Napoleon Hill. And that is a game changer, I tell you. This is a very important and very influential and very book, highly recommend book that I read, because it is the mindset. I mean, this book, Napoleon Hill basically said, desire is the starting point of all achievement. Not a hope, not a wish. It's just a keen, pulsating desire which transcends everything. That's what his, that's his quote. So you have that desire to be rich, then that's more important than anything else. The third book I want to recommend is Slight Edge by Jeff Olson. So it says, okay, small steps compound each and every day over time, give you big success. So the journey is not how much you get. The success is not a result. It happens every day. It doesn't happen in one day. So that's a good book to read. So this is the three books I would recommend people to read if they haven't read.
The best advice Wu has ever received is a very important one for those to remember who are on a property investing journey themselves.
To get to work with a team, to leverage the team's skills and expertise, do not work alone. That's important, because you, no matter how smart you are limited. You are not expert in all areas. So to get the advice of other experts and to humble, to take their opinion. Okay, there are people who seek advice, but they don't listen to the advice. They think they are better than the other expert. But the trick is to be humble, to learn from the advice.
He has some personal mindset habits that he follows that has contributed to his success.
It is belief in something that will come, eventually will be happening. So to believe in the universe has something in store for you, and also have positive thinking. Basically, make sure that you see things, if you like, in a cup half full way than a cup half empty way. So reframe your mindset to look at the good thing of everything, not so much the bad thing of everything. So everything that you look at, that you come across, depends on your mindset, how you frame it. There's some positive and negative. Why not look at it from a positive way rather than a negative way? Because the brain is a very funny organ. It's just guided by what you think. If you think positively, the universe will give you good things. If you keep on thinking in a negative way, this doesn't work, that doesn't work, then guess what? Things will not work. So I guess this is train your brain to have a mindset that everything's look at it positively, and then the universe will reward you.
When it comes to what Wu would tell himself 10 years ago, His reply is succinct and relays an important piece of advice.
Take action, don't procrastinate, and take calculated risk.
He also tells us what he's most looking forward to on his property journey in the next 5 years.
Obviously, to build equity, to create equity, and then to build a portfolio that basically allow passive income to come. And in the journey, also, we need to look at what's not only myself, you know, look at the journey with other professionals, with other clients, I mean, to create wealth ultimately, because obviously at the end of the day, you need something to rely on when you retire. And this is the passive income that you can have when you build your property portfolio. Not a one-day work, it's a long-term work. But as I said before, look at the lesson from Slide Edge. You build one brick at a time. You do things one day at a time. Then success is a daily work.
So small little habits, like I think those little one percenters you continue to do, and as you continue to build that, it leads to great success. And it's so true. It's just consistency.
Actually, this is the thing. I mean, it is easy to do and it's easy not to do. You remember that's the quote from the Slide Edge work, yeah? So a lot of things, it is so simple because just people just overlook it. It is easy to do this sort of thing. Easy to save $100 a week, a month, or whatever. But also easy to spend $100 a week. It's just up to you whether you want to do it on that journey, positive way, or the journey. In accounting term, it's both debit. Debit, whether you debit $100 to asset or you debit $100 to expense. It's both a debit, but depends on how you choose it.
Wu informs us to whether he believes success is more due to hard work and intelligence or luck.
I think luck, as you know, is a lot of people, they define it as when preparation meets opportunity. So I would say at least over 90% is due to hard work and intelligence. And then once you have hard work and intelligence, then you put your preparation and your things together. Then once opportunity comes, that's luck. So I would say luck still have probably 5 to 10%. Like say, for example, you bump into someone which is totally you haven't met before, and that someone may refer you to a deal. And that may be luck, yeah. But then I'll still think, but you haven't got your preparation, you haven't got your mindset to, you know, talk to these people that you bump into. How can you, you know, lead to the successful deal ultimately? So I still think hard work, intelligence account for over 90%. Yeah. It depends on how they define luck and what's their perception on and their background. Maybe they have come across a lot of lucky things, the lotto, the horses, the Melbourne Cup, this sort of stuff. So luck is a very loosely used term, but then I personally think, I mean, people can, or if you like, people can create luck. Like a lot of people say that I don't look for the future, I create my own future. That's a lot of people say.
For those who would like to contact David Wu, you can do so through the following avenues.
You can reach out to me through my email or through the website, www.richardabob.com.au, or you can just give me a call. We are always welcome to share my proper journey and then give them the advice in terms of wealth creations and they help you. Because it is very satisfying to see client with the right guidance and advice walk onto the proper journey and create wealth. And that satisfaction is just beyond money, beyond service fee, and beyond everything.
Thank you to David Wu, our guest on this episode of Property Investory.
Acast powers the world's best podcasts. Here's a show that we recommend.
Welcome back to Two Judgy Girls. I'm Mary from the Bay.
And I'm Courtney from LA. TJG is the podcast where we spill all the tea on your favorite reality TV shows, celebrity gossip, and everything in between. We're here to bring you our unfiltered opinions, hilarious commentary, and plenty of laughs along the way.
We're two SDSU Delta Gamma sisters with a microphone and a whole lot of opinions. Each week, we dive headfirst into the wild world of reality television, from Bravo to all the trash TV you could want. We break down the drama, dissect the latest scandals, and share our thoughts on everything from the jaw-dropping moments to the embarrassing antics.
But that's not all. We're not here to just gossip. We're here to connect with you, the jurors, and share our love of all things pop culture. Whether we're dishing on the latest celebrity breakups, discussing our favorite guilty pleasure movies, or sharing embarrassing stories from our own lives, we promise to keep it real, keep it fun, and keep you coming back for more.
Come judge with us.
Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.